At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
First, there was Tuesday. Then, there was Taco Tuesday. Now at Wendy's, there's Takis Tuesday. Get a new Takis Fuego meal, a.k.a. Takis Fuego chicken sandwich, Fuego fries inspired by Takis, a bag of Takis Fuego chips, a small drink, and also a small Frosty classic. Yes, you can get that any day, but on Takis Tuesday, the Frosty is free. Make every Tuesday a Takis Tuesday. Gotta be Wendy's.
Limited time only. Participating U.S. Wendy's includes 1 ounce Takis Fuego chips while supplies last. Takis and Fuego trademarks are used under license.
Hey y'all, I'm Donna.
And I'm Carrie.
And we are Paranormal Chicks.
Episode 380. So we used to go out to dinner on record nights, and sometimes we'd get started a little late. And so we have lately on record nights been like, look, let's just do something fast. Sometimes we don't even cook. Like, we just, you know, well, I say that like we cook often, but we're like, look, we're just going to get like fast food, eat, record, right? Donna gets McDonald's tonight, and she orders herself a little frappe.
Y'all know I love the frappes.
You know, we're tired. It's been a long week. It's been an incredibly long week, and it's only Wednesday. We're actually recording a day earlier, and it feels like it's like should be Friday.
Literally, when I left today, I said, y'all have a good weekend. Wait, I'll see y'all tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, Donna gets told to pull forward for her frappe to get ready, and she waits, and she waits, and she gets tired of waiting, and she calls McDonald's to say, hey, I'm waiting in, I don't know, parking spot number 3 for my frappe. They said they had to fix the machine. Am I going to get that? I said, you called them?
Sure did.
I said, they don't spit in your shit.
As long as it's on top and I can't see it, it doesn't exist to me.
Well, did I find a rubber band in my hamburger tonight? I did. Did I still eat said hamburger? I did.
I don't know why you eat hamburgers anymore. You find the weirdest shit in your hamburgers. They're always pink.
It's a problem.
Like, I'm like, I don't understand.
Like, raw pink. Like, it's not even just like, oh, it's a little pink. Like,
no one else will be like that. Carrie's will.
Completely raw. Oh, well. I definitely had issues with our food tonight.
Well, and then I get here and I'm like, oh, great. I have a flat tire,
too. Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
So it's just been real sunshiny. Not because it's freaking raining all week long.
For like 2 weeks straight, it's been raining. We are just positive Pollies this week, aren't we?
Okay. Ooh. Woosah, we're like shimmy shaking that off. Flick your nipples. Let them get hard. Feel better.
They already were a little bit.
Okay, now we go into heavier stuff.
Right, y'all. I just told Don, I was like, I'm so glad I go first this week because my story is heavy. Heavy.
But before we do get to the heavy lifting, and I'm not talking about her trying to pick me up, we just want to remind you that New Orleans trip coming up next month, like this time next month, we will be sweating our balls off, but having a blast from July 25th through the 27th. We have lots of things planned, and you can go at your own pace too. You don't have to do everything.
Yeah. We also have the cruise coming up in November, and that one you got to go to crimewaveatsea.com/creep and put in your stuff, and they'll send you all the things about the cruise. I am so excited.
Me too. Like, oh my goodness. Also, the content we're going to get from that, me and you sharing a freaking room.
Y'all might need to join the Patreon because it's probably going to end up being an extra slice on there.
Uh-huh.
Like, we're going to get back and we're going to just, like, unfurl our scroll of things that we did to piss each other off.
Yeah, like, I could talk to her about that right now, but I'll save it for the podcast. Let me write it in my notes app. It's not just us on the cruise. It's Sinisterhood, last podcast on the left, Scared to Death. I am so excited. If y'all love Scared to Death like I do, let me know because I love Lindsay, I love her socks. I love everything about her. Dan, his last name's Cummings. How can you not like that? Yeah, I am super excited. There's so many more podcasts too, but like those are the ones, you know, like Sinisterhood and Scared to Death. I'm going to be like elbowing y'all out of the way to be like, sign my boobs. But let's just be real. They probably would have more room on my forehead.
Yeah. I'm so freaking excited about this cruise. Like, we're taking a vacation.
Oh my God.
But also podcasty and the sun and the sea and the drinks and the food and the food and the food.
And can you imagine if we get to collab with any of these podcasters?
I may die.
One, we'll have to act like we're professional. We're like, oh yeah, we've been doing this for 7 years. Just don't listen to our podcast because
we're great.
We are. I mean, shit show, but it's a good one. It's a kind of, you know, the reality TV kind of like, we're not the hard-hitting journalism. We are the...
They're like the Bachelor. We're like 90 Day Fiancé.
Oh, yeah.
Still really great TV.
Yeah. And you know what? You learn a lot on 90 Day Fiancé.
Y'all, I have to tell y'all what my big ass mouth did this weekend. I think I told you this already, Donna. So I went to another one of my nephew's baseball tournaments this weekend. And this last game that I went to, they're only supposed to be an hour and 40 minutes. And this game lasted forever because there was some drama about they tried to substitute a kid. And so it was like they were pulling like the tournament lead things in there, trying to figure all that, you know, just shit that happens. Well, the other thing was the home plate umpire kept getting hurt. Like, this motherfucker got hit by the ball 4 times. And I'm talking, he had to have been vying for some workers' comp or something, because he didn't just get hit by the ball. He would, like, writhe on the ground in pain. Y'all, it's 10U. Those balls are coming in at 55 miles an hour. Does it hurt? Fuck yes. Does it hurt that bad? No. Like, he looks like he got hit in the face with a ball at 90 miles an hour, and it hit his shoulder by a 10-year-old. Like, I'm talking one time, he literally was writhing on the ground. The coaches ran over there. He got up on his knee, and they were, like, holding his arms over his head because he couldn't catch his breath.
Now, he might have had something else going on.
Donna, that's not what you're supposed to do when someone can't catch their breath. You don't hold your hands over your head. You have to prop your arms up on something because that lets all of your muscles expand your chest. You're actually making it harder to breathe when you're raising your arms overhead.
Oh, well, I just meant in general.
No. I think... It was 7 o'clock and he had been out there all damn day and was hot as shit and was just over life. But y'all, the last time that he got hit by the ball, you know, somebody gets hit by the ball and everybody's like, ooh, and then like it gets quiet because he's like rolling around in pain. And just as it gets quiet, I did not realize I was saying this out loud. I out loud went, why doesn't he duck?
Oh, my God.
My two sisters that were there were dying. I was like, oh, my. I got so embarrassed because I didn't realize. Like, that was an inside thought that accidentally came out.
Then you had to duck.
I did not know I said it. Like, I did not mean to say it, period. Much less as loud as I said it. I was so embarrassed. But we were also cracking up because, bro, why aren't you ducking?
Yeah.
I mean, I know it's coming in fast, like, especially when it's, like, tipped by the bat or something. Like, it is coming in fast, but he just stands there.
Yeah. Also, I like the little Sandlot reference you had in the forever.
Oh, that's just how I talk.
Oh. Well, I was like, I mean, I know we talk about it, but, like, you know, it's Sandlot and then it's baseball.
Yeah. I'm that smart.
All right. Let's get on with it before Colby has to air up my tire in the dark.
And the rain.
Well, it's supposed to stop raining, ma'am. I checked.
So the story this week came from a recommendation in the email from Ronnie L. This is a pretty big story. And as with any like huge story that has a lot of coverage, there is literally no way I'm going to get everything into this episode because there are podcasts that have like multiple parts on this, and the parts will be like an hour and a half each. So clearly, I'm not going to be able to get every single part of this story into this, but Man, y'all, this is a heavy story. Okay, so first we're going to start with a couple, Cameron and Janice Hooker. They met in 1973, and at this time, Janice was just 16 years old, but within 2 years, they got married. Now, Cameron was like a lumber mill worker.
How old was he? You said she was only 16, but how old was he?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, but they waited 2 years, so I didn't know if they were both like 16 and had to wait. Fuck if I know.
So it says that Cameron was born in 1953, so he would have been 20.
Oh.
Here's the thing, though. They did have a little bit of like bondage in their relationship, like little BDSM action, but it seems like Janice wasn't really into it, and Cameron was like really into it.
I am sorry. I think I shared this clip in the Facebook group because there, you know, I love Love Island, but there's this one guy on there, Austin, and he says all the things all the time. And it was like a bondage scene that they were doing. And the host was like, does anyone have kinks? You know? And this one girl was like, I like being tied up. And she said it in the same cadence as the, like, I like to say like cuss words, like fuck is my favorite cuss word. Do you know that?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, he says, yeah, I like to be tied up, a little hot candle wax, a little public sex. And I'm like, holy fuck. Like, you're telling all of this. And then I'm like, oh, wait, I tell all of that on the podcast.
I'm like, what are you holy fucking about?
But it's just like, it went from like zero to like 100 with him. And so it was like, to me, that was kind of them. Like, yeah, I like this. But then he liked like XYZ to the nth degree.
Well, this ain't that. This is way, way more than that.
Oh, God. Is this? Oh, God.
Just get ready. This is a heavy story. So Janice actually was like, I'm not into that at all, actually. And I don't want to do it. And so they agreed that Cameron could keep, quote, a slave. This story is about Colleen Stan that I'm about to tell you. Now, it's alleged that Colleen wasn't the first girl that they kidnapped, but this part that I'm about to tell you right now was never proven, and nobody was ever charged with murder for this. So, allegedly is all I'm going to say. So, there was a girl, Marie Elizabeth Sponick, and I don't know if I'm saying her name correctly.
I don't think you're saying it right either, but I can't really remember. But I did a different version of this story. Like, it was a quick overview of them. It was more about a lady and her living in an apartment and having these psychic dreams. And her name was Jodie Foster, not the actress. And this was on episode 263, if you want to go back.
Well, I Googled how to pronounce the name, and literally everything I clicked on said it differently. But it seems like Spanhake is the consensus. Either way, she was a 19-year-old girl when she moved to Chico, California. She was on a shopping trip on January 31st, 1976, when she went missing. The police and everybody looked for Marie, and no one can find her. But we do find out from Janice that she said that the two of them actually kidnapped, tortured, and murdered Marie. She said that Marie was walking home when they picked her up, took her to their house where they ended up hanging her by her wrists in the basement and torturing her for a whole day. Then Cameron shot her in the stomach with a pellet gun and strangled her. They wrapped her body in a blanket. They buried her in a shallow grave in a national park. But the police never could find any remains, and so there was literally no proof of murder, and so no charges have ever been brought in her case. But that brings us to Colleen Stan. Now, Colleen, 20 years old, I really didn't find a lot. Now, there's like books on this story and movies on this story. This is a pretty big story, but other than just like regular websites, like there wasn't much on her background. Obviously, in books and other podcasts, they had a lot more, but Case File podcast has a pretty good bit on her background if you want to delve into that. But on May 19th of 1977, Colleen lived in Eugene, Oregon, and she wanted to go to her friend's house in Westwood, California, because it was her friend's birthday, and she was like, I want to go, and she didn't have a vehicle to get there, and so she decided to hitchhike. This was quite the trek for her, so she was going to have to get in multiple different cars to get her down Interstate 5, which she had done, and there had been a couple of cars that had stopped that she actually didn't get in because she didn't get a good vibe, and so she was like, nah, I'm not doing that. Then a car pulls up and there's a man driving with his wife and she was holding a baby. And so Colleen felt comfortable getting in their car. Unfortunately, that was Cameron and Janice Hooker. At one point, they had stopped at a gas station and Colleen went in to use the bathroom and she almost ran because it was like something came all over her and was like, you have to get out now. But she didn't. She just kind of calmed herself down and went back and got in the car. Well, after about 20 minutes of driving, Cameron says that there were some caves that they wanted to look in. And Colleen being like, well, I mean, I can't really tell them no. They're giving me a ride. So they stop. Janice gets out of the car and goes down to this kind of lake area. And Cameron gets in the back seat and puts a knife to Colleen's throat. Now, there was this box, and Cameron ended up putting this box over Colleen's head. And it was like this weird wooden box, like a head box is what they called it. And it was almost like a deprivation chamber. Like it was intended to block out light, sound, even like fresh air from coming in. So they put that on her head and drove her to their house. This next part, y'all, there's a lot of really harsh details in this. So if this story is too heavy for you, we completely understand. Please skip it. But it seems like exactly what happened to Maria, they did to Colleen. They took her into the basement and literally hung her up by her arms. And it was super painful. And she would try to reach anything with her feet to take the pressure off of her arms. Cameron was whipping her, and at this point, I think she was blindfolded without the box, because the box, it seems like it's meant for you to not be able to see out of, but she could see out of it a little bit. On the case law website, they called it a blindfold at this point. So through the blindfold, like I said, she could see a little bit, and after about 10 or 15 minutes, they put her like a box under her so that she could take some pressure off her arms. While she was able to kind of stand up for a minute, she can see Cameron and Janice having sex. After they finished, they let her hang for another 10 to 15 minutes before they took her down and had the box on her head and chained her wrists and her feet to the box. Now, into the first couple of days that they held her captive in the house, they did give her some food, but, I mean, she wasn't able to eat. And they continued with the beatings and hanging her. And then for the next 5 months, she was kept naked, bound, and with some form of like blindfold or that big box on her head.
I can't even fucking imagine.
Well, and that box was like 20 pounds.
Yeah.
Like, I just think about, like, this is so trivial, but I just think about like carrying a backpack or a purse for so long and how much it makes your shoulders and your head and your neck hurt. And it's like, she was naked and chained and terrified and I'm sure thirsty and hungry and like, where's she going to the bathroom and all the things with a 20-pound box on her head. That's literally like a deprivation chamber.
Oh, God. Oh, and had no downtime.
Yeah. Janice and Cameron had a deal, though. While he was able to keep someone captive, he was not allowed to have sexual intercourse with the person that he was keeping. That was kind of their deal. So for a while, while there was beatings and sexual assault, it wasn't through penetration. But the abuse was pretty bad. Like I said, she would be at various times suspended from the rafters. Things were done to like block her breathing. Like I'm thinking like some choking and stuff. She was continually whipped with the box on her head. And then they would also shock her with electrical cords. They burned her genitalia with a heat lamp.
Oh my God.
And then would like put her down into a bath until she wasn't able to breathe. Well, now remember, she was abducted in May, and by October, Cameron had built what they are calling like a triangular shaped box, but basically it would fit under the stairs and it was like, quote, her workshop. Now, they actually moved around a decent amount. So Colleen would spend the day chained and inside that air quotes workshop area, and then at night, she would either be forced to do stuff around the house or more abuse. But here's the thing. Colleen was terrified. Aside from all the other things that was actually happening to her, the hookers were telling her that they were part of this organization called The Company. And that this company buys and sells people. They human traffic. And that if people tried to escape, they would be tortured. I mean, she's already being tortured, so you can only imagine where her mind went as to what the torture she would experience if she tried to escape. But it wouldn't only happen to her, it would happen to her family as well, because the hookers told her that they had people everywhere, always watching and always making sure that people were not escaping. And I mean, why wouldn't Colleen believe that? I mean, she's literally being held captive. Just hasn't been human trafficked yet. You know, she's literally being held captive, all the sexual assault, all the abuse. Mm-hmm. So why wouldn't she believe that?
Well, and they built that box and stuff to put her in. So it's like, oh, this is probably how they traffic people and, you know, all of that too. So it's like very believable, very believable.
Well, on that case law website, the court documents said that they would reinforce this alleged company any way they could. So one time Janice had to have knee surgery, and basically they said, I think more Cameron than Janice with this, said that, yeah, she had once been someone who tried to escape, and that when she was caught, they hurt her knee, and that's why she had to have this knee surgery. So now we're in January of 1978. So this is what, 8 months since her abduction? And they force Colleen to sign a, quote, slave contract. And
I mean, you're just getting around to that now?
Well, I mean, I don't know. This is so fucking dumb to me, too, because it's like, I mean, what in the fucking Scientology? You're going to sign your soul away? Like, I don't know. Like this would stand up anywhere because she's signing under duress,
right?
But also like you would ever take this anywhere because you're literally signing her as a, quote, slave, that it said that he owned her soul. So it's like, okay. But Colleen was like, no. And they were like, yeah, because I've got somebody from the company waiting. And so, of course, Colleen's like, fuck, somebody from the company's here. Like, I don't want to be even more tortured. So she signed. And from that point on, they called Colleen just K. And she was forced to call the hookers master or sir and Janice ma'am. And I think this is where, for lack of a better word, the brainwashing really began, too. Because at this point, they put a collar on Colleen's neck, and she had to kneel or bow her head. She had to ask for permission to do literally anything. And remember how I said that the deal was there was no sexual intercourse, albeit non-consensual. That was like the rule with Janice and Cameron. And by February of 78, this rule in their relationship was void. I think at first Janice was like, this might kind of excite her. And so she watched as Cameron raped Colleen, but after it, she was like, no, I actually, that really upset me. Like, I didn't like that. And so it stopped for a little while. Now, in April, they moved to a mobile home. And of course, Colleen went with them. The Hookers had a waterbed, and they built a like pedestal for it. And under the waterbed was the special box that they made for Colleen. So now Colleen, instead of being in her stupid-ass workshop, because I hate even calling it that, but instead of being like under the stairs, now she's forced to spend essentially the entire day under the fucking waterbed. Because at this point, you know, they had a kid. You got to remember, all this is happening while they have a child living in the house. And so the kid starts to get older. And so they would make Colleen spend the whole day underneath the bed. And then she was only allowed out at night after the kid went to bed. So if she had to use the bathroom, she had a bedpan in the box with her that she would have to like shimmy with her feet to be able to get on to be able to use the bathroom.
Not no way, not no how for me. Like there's no way.
I literally cannot even wrap my brain around the level of pure hell that Colleen went through.
No, one, my leg would catch a cramp trying to get that up.
I literally thought that too. Like I can't even imagine that. Like just the thought of being in a box that closed with a literal fucking waterbed over me.
Oh God.
It makes me have a hard time breathing, much less being stuck there for, I mean, some stuff said 23 of the 24 hours a day. She'd only be out, let out for like an hour for them to fucking rape and torture her.
And again, with all this fucking room under a waterbed.
I know. Well, this was like a pedestal that they specifically built up for this. Yeah. But yeah, I know the case you're talking about. Well, and then in September of 78, so we are a year and 3 months into this, Janice fucking gives birth to their second child on the waterbed while Colleen is stuck in the box under the waterbed.
What the actual fuck?
So flash forward to April of 79 to January of 80.
Holy fuck.
3 years now. Janice was working nights. And dipshit was, like, they had opposite schedules. Wow, that was really hard for me to get out. But when he was home alone, he would let Colleen out to do all the shit he didn't want to do. Like, fix his dinner, wash the dishes, all of that shit. But then, by June of that year, Janice got a day job as well. So then, they forced Colleen to stay at home with the kids while they were fucking at work. But you have to remember, they're 3 years into this.
Oh, she yeah, is, absolutely.
I mean, totally down. Like, the psychological torture that she has been through, they literally could leave the house and she wasn't going anywhere because she was so fucking terrified.
Yeah, and then now they have two kids
mm-hmm.
in this whole mix. Like, you can't kidnap their kids, but you don't want to leave them at, you don't, like, oh
I know,
my gosh.
I know. And it seems like, though, this really was one of the better times for Colleen because she was out during the day. And then at night, she would be in the bathroom chained to the toilet versus under the waterbed. So, I mean, still fucking horrible, but it seems like a little bit better than it was before. So even then, you can think about how she's like, well, this actually isn't so bad. Like, you know, reasoning herself into not running and staying with her fear and all.
Mm-hmm.
But then not long after that, old dipshit was like, actually, Janice, you need to stay home because Colleen has to go back in the box.
Can you imagine finding out your coworkers have kidnapped a girl, have raped, have tortured for years, has like all of this, like they went to work. They had coworkers. They had all of this. And when this comes out, oh my God.
Now, Colleen would do some, I don't even know what this means, but again, the case law said that Colleen would do some piece work for Janice's company. It was like an electronics company. And so I guess she would, I don't know, put shit together. And so she would get some money, and but that would go straight to the hookers. But I don't know. And all that, because also, I don't understand how that worked, because all this time, her family had filed a missing persons report. So I don't know why that wouldn't, I mean, I guess because it's the fucking 1980, but like why that wouldn't have been like, ding, 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 this person has a missing persons out for them, but here's your W-2, you know?
They probably didn't give her a W-2 and she just like worked under the table.
Maybe. So this is some pretty graphic parts of stuff that like we know happened to her. So if you need to fast forward through this, you can. When Janice was gone one time with the two kids to a birthday party, he sodomized Colleen. He would like force objects into her, like a whip, all kinds of things. He would put her on this, like, quote, stretcher that was basically a, like, not a gurney stretcher, like a medieval to pull her arms and her legs tight stretcher. And while she was on the stretcher, he forced her to perform fellatio. I feel like I worded that weird, but here we are. Again, she was raped multiple times while being suspended in the air. And he would really rape her anywhere. Like, he would tie her to a television. He would tie her on a freaking, like, frame of a door. He would tie her literally anywhere he wanted and rape her. And she did the best she could to get out of this situation. She told him that she loved him, trying to see if like he would give her a little more freedom. And it may have worked, because after about 3 years, she was able to call her family. And now, of course, he was sitting right there. But she was able to call her family one day and they're all like, holy shit, like, can't believe that she actually called him, because they didn't know where she had been for the last 3 years. And I think that her family did a really good job of not pushing her to be like, hey, you know, where have you, well, I mean, of course they asked, where have you been? But, you know, like, I just think that they did a really good job of not pushing her to where she would shut down, because she couldn't open up more. Now, eventually, they actually did go to her family's house, but Cameron had told Colleen that he had put up a $30,000 security deposit to cover the company's cost to watch Colleen while she was with her family. So she was fucking terrified. So she was like not going to do anything out the way while she was seeing her family, because she'd, it was for their safety and hers. Before they did take this trip, though, he had basically, kind of how Errol Castro would do, where he would set up tests for them so they never knew if it was really safe to try to run. So she thought she was going to the family's house, and they like drove off. And I mean, just like they were going on their trip, and then he brought her back home and then made her put a gun in her mouth and pull the trigger, but it was empty. So she thought she was going, got in this car to leave, and then he brought her back home and did that all as like a test to see if she would obey.
I can't imagine what she's going through physically, mentally, all of it.
Well, and then before they actually, like, so after that, when they were on their way, they stopped in Sacramento at, air quotes, the company headquarters. And he tells her, look, they're going to give you a lie detector test and you better fucking pass it. And this is to make sure that she's not going to run. Like, basically, the test itself, he told her, was, we're going to make sure you're not going to run, kind of thing. So he leaves her in the car, goes into this place that he's pretending like is the headquarters, comes back out and is like, oh, they actually waived the test. So lucky for you. So you better not fuck up, kind of thing. So Colleen does go and see her family. And she spends like 24 hours with them. But this is too where I'm talking about her family did a really good job of not pushing her. Like, they would ask her questions and all of that, but they weren't doing it in a way that was going to make her shut down, you know?
They're better than me because I would be so terrible at that.
Same. And like, the family actually thought that she had joined a cult because just that she had been gone so long. And then when she came back, she was in like homemade clothes and all of that. And so it was like, did she join a cult? But then Cameron comes in and pretends like he is her boyfriend. And they ended up even like taking some pictures with the family and everything. And they're like, okay, well, can we have your number so we can call you? And he's like, oh, no, we're moving. So we'll call y'all back. So after they come back from Janice's house, he, again, to make sure that she's compliant, rapes her and puts her back in the box under the waterbed. And then from March of 81 to May of 84, Colleen lives basically her whole existence in this box. Some of the timelines are a little confusing to me because something said that the kids like didn't even know that she was there. But then other stuff said that she like babysat them some. And that there were times that like she was even allowed to go outside with the kids and all of that. And at one point, she even gets a job as a maid at, I think, a hotel. But she, I mean, think of how many years this has been. Like, she is so terrified and so brainwashed that she is too fearful to even leave. Even when she's out somewhere without the hookers with her, because they've convinced her that the company is watching. Now, in 83, Cameron tells Janice that he had been preparing dungeons so that he could have like as many as 4 women that he kept. And now Janice and Colleen had been helping him like build these, I guess, underground bunkers is what you would call them. Like, it was these big holes that had some concrete. And so I guess that's what he was planning on using them for. But Janice was pretty upset with this, and that she had also found out that he had been having sexual intercourse, aka raping her, but that wasn't part of their agreement. And so kind of finding out that and all these things, I think it began to take a toll on Janice. So eventually, though, Janice is going to church because they seemed like they were a little religious, like in religious being that Cameron used the Bible to get what he wanted and basically was like, hey, Janice, you have to submit to me. You're my slave. Like, Abraham's wives were slaves to him. And so he was like, basically, now you're both my slaves and I'm going to like alternate what nights I have sex with you. And this just isn't sitting right with Janice. And she actually kind of opens up to one of her church pastors about things. And everything says that the pastor was like, you need to go to the police. And I'm like, hold on. The pastor didn't go to police? Like, you're not like a fucking Catholic priest where you've got the, like, it's like this sacred, you can't tell. Like, you're telling me you didn't go to police? Like, what did she tell you? Because it could have just been he's having an affair with her, you know, and she didn't tell all of it. But I'm like, this fucking pastor didn't go to police? Well, at this point, Janice is really struggling, basically having a nervous breakdown. And she takes Colleen to work one day, because remember how I told you she's working at that hotel, and she's like, I gotta tell her. And so she tells Colleen that the company wasn't real. And
can you imagine?
No.
Well, one, she's probably like, this is a test.
Exactly. And so apparently after this, they both like go see the pastor and then go back to their house that night. And Janice didn't tell Cameron that she had told Colleen because she was scared that he would kill them. Well, then, basically the next day or two, when Cameron goes to work, Janice and Colleen takes the kids and goes to Janice's parents' house. And then Colleen calls her parents and they wire her bus fare. And so the next day, she leaves to go home. But Colleen does call Cameron from the bus stop, and she told him that she was leaving. There was nothing he could do. And the next day, she's with her family. She had been gone and held captive for 7 years.
That, I can't even fucking imagine that.
But Janice goes back to Cameron and she's like, we're done with this. Like, you need to destroy all of like your bondage equipment. Like, I'm done. But she hid some of the things so that they weren't destroyed. She says she was scared that he would use them on her with Colleen gone. So she ends up going back to her house, and months go by, and Colleen is living back with her family, but she does keep calling and sending letters to the Hookers. And I really think that this just shows you how much she had been brainwashed. Mm-hmm. I mean, 7 years. I mean, just think about, I know this is like a terrible comparison because it's not the same, but just look at some of these reality shows like Big Brother and how much those people change being locked in that house for like even a couple of months. I mean, they're there three months, but even the ones that aren't there till the end, like people develop relationships that they think it's like the love of their life. Mm-hmm. And it's like because you're in isolation.
Yeah.
And so I know that that is like obviously not the same, but you're on a fucking TV show. You have all the luxuries. You can go out and swim in a pool and you can do all of the things. You just can't talk to anybody on the phone. Whereas she's literally being tortured and lied to that there's this company that is going to sell her off and like traffic her and kill her family, you know? So of course there's going to still be some of that. But eventually on November 7th, I think Janice really had enough of it. She had talked to some friends. She had talked to her pastor. And I think apparently this time the pastor actually contacted police and they arrested Cameron on charges of kidnapping, false imprisonment, and multiple sexual offenses. Janice ended up taking a plea deal and was like got immunity for her plea deal.
Oh my God.
And she was, well, her and of course Colleen were like key witnesses for his trial. His defense was trying to show like aspects of Colleen's life before they kidnapped her. About, like, her sexual conduct.
Oh, my God.
Which is literally the most disgusting thing. Well, I mean, not of this whole story, not the most disgusting mm-hmm. thing. But, like, of course you fucking would.
Yeah.
But, thankfully, the court was like, absolutely not. There were over 100 pieces of physical evidence, including the head box, photographs, the contract, and the fucking waterbed and the box. And the stretcher.
Oh my gosh.
Now, Janice, of course, downplays her involvement as far as like she says that she tried to get Colleen to leave years before, and Colleen's like, no, she fucking didn't. Multiple psychologists were part of this talking about how Colleen would be coerced and was coerced into staying and obeying him, and he would like how he controlled. Literally everything, like what she ate, what she drank, her clothing, abused her, you know, her having to use the bathroom there, like even just throwing her off as far as daylight. I mean, you know, just all the things. And so they really showed the torture and how it affected her. That motherfucker testified on his own behalf. Of course he did.
Ugh.
But the jury found him guilty of kidnapping using a deadly weapon, forcible oral copulation, penetration with a foreign object, forcible sodomy, and 6 counts of rape. The weirdest thing is there was a 7th count of rape that was a hung jury. I'm like, what? How?
Right? Like, that doesn't even fucking make sense.
Yes. So he was sentenced to 25 years for the kidnapping, 5 to 10 years for the weapon enhancement. Basically, he ended up being sentenced to a total of 104 years. And then Colleen did, like, there's been movies about this. There was I think it was a Lifetime movie.
Mm-hmm. Girl in the Box.
Girl in the Box, yeah. And then, I mean, there's tons and tons and tons. But now, Cameron originally had a parole date that was supposed to be for 2023, but they moved it up to 2015. and his parole was denied. And then he was supposed to be eligible again in 2030. But because of the COVID pandemic, they were like, well, maybe we should give him parole. And then they were like, well, you know what? Instead of parole, let's have him evaluated by the state hospital. And they classified him as a sexually violent predator. And
you don't say.
Yeah. And then he was released into the state hospitals. Like, from what I saw, even into this year, he could still potentially, like, be let go.
Holy fuck.
Yes. Now, Colleen is trying her best to live her best life. She did interviews with, like, People Magazine and stuff, and she said that she learned that she could go anywhere in her mind. You just have to remove yourself from the real situation going on, and you go somewhere else. You go somewhere pleasant, around people you love, whatever makes you happy.
Like, she endured, she learned shit that, like, the Marines have to learn.
Uh-huh. Yep. Seems like she's still living in California. She's been married 4 times, which I'm sure she has some demons that she, you know what I mean? Like,
all that trauma?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I mean, like, how do you even have a normal sexual relationship with your partner?
Well, because that's the thing, too. Like, yeah, they took 7 years of her life from her, but they're going to always affect her.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the People article, it said that she was, like, raising a 2-year-old grandson. So it seems like she had kids and that she's literally just doing her best. She says, your life is just kind of in limbo when you're in captivity. And once you get that freedom back, you have that choice again. And it's like the gates open and you just run for it.
Oh, gosh.
She said, I thoroughly enjoy my freedom. Always, always, always. Life today is good. You have to learn how to live in the now and not let the past drag you back. And that was from this Oxygen documentary, Snap's Notorious Girl in the Box. So there were a couple of People articles, of course, Wikipedia, KRCR-TV, The Case Law, and then The Oxygen. But I just think about, too, I mean, it really seems like she helped raise those kids. I mean, those kids have to be, I mean, almost our age.
Yeah.
And so it's like, how do you reconcile that your parents, that person that you that lived with y'all, your parents were keeping them captive?
Right. Well, and then, you know, you're attached to the kids because it's not the kids' fault.
Right.
So you have this, like, you want to protect them. You're like a mother figure to them, mm-hmm. just because you're trying to keep them safe, even though you're not safe. And then you have to leave for the betterment of, you know, your fucking life.
Right.
But then they're not in your life anymore. Oh, my God. Attachment issues over
yeah.
here. Like, I just can't even imagine.
Well, and then because Janice got, like, immunity, did she get to keep her kids? Like,
oh, she better not have.
I don't know. And I think she's, like, living in her under her maiden name now. But she's, like, out living her life. I mean, she never went to jail. She got immunity.
Yeah.
And I do think that she was a victim in this. Not the extent to Colleen, but I do feel like she was at some point a victim. But we've talked about this before. You know, at what point are you a perpetrator too? When does that line get crossed? And how do you decide that line, you know?
Yeah.
Because is her not getting Colleen out, is she a perpetrator? Or was she victimized, you know, the same way Colleen was, with fear and abuse?
I'm sure it was, but it's like, I don't know. I think she should have got more than what she got.
Yeah. I mean, you had somebody living in a fucking box under your bed. Like,
that really was heavy.
Sorry that I chose a story you had done before.
Well, no, because mine, again, focused on the paranormal aspect of this apartment, and it focused more on Marie, who...
Maria?
No, I think her name was Marie, and she went... They called her, like, Marliz or something like that, and so it was about that one, the one that she hasn't been found and all of that.
Wait, so you're telling me that I called her Maria and nobody batted a fucking eye?
I thought you did say Marie.
I may have said both.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, Carrie carried that up. But I'm really glad she did that because I didn't know all of the details, but I did know about like the girl in the box and stuff like that. It's just when you lay it all out there, the 7 years and oh my gosh.
I think about that in terms of my life and I'm like, that's how long we've been doing the podcast.
Yeah.
Living in a fucking box.
Whew. Okay, so let me set this scene for you. We are going to a tiny, quiet little place called Angola, New York. But it was actually the town of Evans, but it became Angola. Like, Angola was the bigger part. Evans was, like, a town of the village of Angola. I feel like I just did the caterpillar thing that, like, the caterpillar ate the thing, or you know what I'm talking about? The hungry caterpillar, or the bump on the log in the bottom of the sea. Something like that. It's like, it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
But being that small, it's the kind of place where, you know, you move a little slower than everywhere else. I would fit in there. You have gas stations, diners, you have some neighborhoods, and then you have this one place called Holland Road, or as the locals like to call it, Pigman's Road.
I don't like pigs.
Well, they're cute, the potbelly ones.
No, well, I don't like wild pigs, I guess I should
say.
That's
like a boar.
Yeah, like that shit's scary. Actually, I was just listening to a podcast today and they were talking about how fucking scary hogs are.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, damn, that's so true.
Yeah, but like the potbelly pigs, I like to watch them on TikTok. Like they like get up like the dogs, how your mom had the stairs.
Yes. Well, actually, the lady that cleans my house has three and she sent me a video today showed me of them in their little swimming pool, and it was very cute.
Oh my gosh. I'm just saying, she could make some side money letting people swim with the pigs. Just saying.
Would you do that?
Absolutely. Now, back to Angola, but now I'm like daydreaming over here about her bringing the pigs over to your house and us being all in the pool. But, you know, whatever. Well,
okay, first of all, not going to happen because they would poop in the pool, and this was a kiddie pool.
I know, but I would take up the kiddie pool. I got to be where they can be free and me be free.
Yeah, they're not shitting in my pool, Donna.
Okay. Angola is a little south of Buffalo. It's a kind of blink and you miss it place. It was settled in the early 1800s. And like a lot of places in that part of the state and that time, the history is tied tightly to the railroads. And it's a kind of town that, you know, the train didn't just pass through, it built the community. It's like when the boom towns would happen. Well, when this railroad came through, it's like, oh, well, people would be going to, you know, point A to point B. Let's put a hotel here. Let's do this. It needs to have a rest stop. It needs to have this. And so the town literally was built around railroads. But in that same thing that built this community has the same connection that led to one of the darkest tragedies in that area. And it's called the Angola Horror. Horror, whichever way you say it. So picture it. Angola, New York, 1867. A passenger train was just making its way through, like always, like toot toot. But the rear cars jumped the track over Big Sister Creek. And it wasn't just like a derailment. Like one of the cars fell into the gorge. And when that happened, the kerosene stoves like set everything ablaze. Immediately, people were trapped. People were screaming. It was mass chaos. And 50 lives were lost to this fire, to this train wreck. And now, this could have all been a freak accident. Others say it was the Derricks family. And that was a father named Elijah or Elisa, I think. And he had two teen boys, Loring and Henry. They lived close to Holland Road, a.k.a. Pigman Road. But that's what that wasn't called that at this time. And they report they lived on the wrong side of the tracks. And literally, they discovered if they walked next to the train tracks, they could pick up the coal that had fallen off the train and stuff, so they could use that to heat up their house.
God, that's awful.
Right? So in December, they were walking along the railroad, picking up coal and whatnot, but the boys knew that their family needed some supplies to repair their fence. And they saw these two braces, like the ties that held the railroad together. And they were like, oh, we can use these to hold up the fence. In the scheme of things, you think, oh, two little things on this huge railroad, nothing's going to happen, you know. But with that, everything happened, because those were the wooden braces that the rails were attached to. Now, the police tried to cover it up because it was the worst tragedy in town, hence the name of the Angola Horror. But the family was kind of shunned from the gossip that had gotten around. You know, the official report said it was because it, quote, ran over a frog in the track. And now at first I was like, a frog, like ribbit, ribbit. But a frog is a crossing point of two trails, and so it's like the switch in the tracks.
Oh.
Yeah, but I was like, a frog? But anyway. But what they said is one of the wheels must have been loose or defective, and when it hit that spot, that it was cold, and when they took off those braces, it gave a little way for it to be a little off, and that one wheel hit it, and it was just like the worst case scenario. Oh, and a little tidbit here that it's neither here nor there, but John D. Rockefeller was running late on the day that he had planned to be on that exact train.
Damn.
And since he had gotten up late, like everything, it was like the no good, terrible, bad day, very bad day. And he got there, his bags made it on the train, but it pulled away before he was on there.
Damn.
Yeah, like a fucking close call. And then, I mean, at this point he was rich, but then he went on to be like one of the richest people ever. Now, fast forward a bit to 1906. And this is when a building was destroyed by a fire. And everyone was like, guess who did that too? The Derricks family. And it was just, you know, like, I kind of feel like making a murderer where something shitty happens, blame it on that family over there. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they were under suspicion for that, but no one could prove anything. And so again, town gossip was that the Derricks were responsible. But one July 4th, Loring was trying to kind of build a community for him. And like, just, hey, I'm not this bad guy, I swear, you know, like, just trying to open things up. And so he set off this 4th of July display, like he was going to put it on for the town. He set it off, and it turned into a terrible time for people because people got severely burned because the fireworks didn't work properly, which I understand that. Me and Tiffany just talked about that. We like fireworks, but we don't like being close to them when they're set off. Because my brother-in-law, my ex-brother-in-law, set off some fireworks and they weren't even that close to us, but it fell over and it was one of those that had like four big, like, boom, boom, you know. So four of those fuckers came right at us and like we went into their garage to try to get away and one like ricocheted over there. It was so fucking scary.
I was actually there that time.
Ugh, I don't like it. So I'm like, I love fireworks, but I just need them to be away and be like professionally done. Well, the town got sued because a lot of people were hurt and Loring was more blackballed by the town. But Loring found love in a hopeless place. But it was with Betsy Crabtree, who was also shunned because her parents were first cousins. So it's these two people that like kind of, you know, well, we're here and no one else likes us, so let's be together kind of thing. They were bonded by their trauma, really. And they had a baby boy in 1913 whose name is William Derricks. Now, he was born with frontonasal dysplasia, which was like his nose was split. His eyes were like very separated and he had a deep cleft lip.
Was this what his parents were the first cousins?
No, who knows? But no, his mom, her parents were the first cousins.
Hmm.
Yeah. And people said that he looked like a pig. And the town said it was basically the family's curse because of all the harm that the family had caused the community.
You know, or the fact that their gene pool was more of a kiddie pool instead of an Olympic pool.
Right. And now with all this happening, the family, Loring, Betsy, and William became even more withdrawn because they had both been outcast in the community. So they didn't want that for their son because, you know, that he would go out and people would make fun of him and all of this. And it's hard to watch your kid be kicked, but you're also down, so you can't really do anything, you feel. Now, William grew up and he had a lack of education because they kind of kept him home then. And he started doing like apprentice work at a butcher shop. But he was just doing like some on-the-job training, apprentice stuff, basically like cleaning up all the shit.
Literally shit and blood and guts and stuff. Also, this has given me the beginnings of a Criminal Mind episode.
Yeah. Well, it reminds me of another story, but I'll talk about that in a minute that I've covered. But like I mentioned in previous stories about people with birth defects or abnormalities, he found work later being part of a sideshow. Now, around 1950, William moved back to Angola and he married Mildred Crabtree. Now, that really was his first cousin.
Oh my God.
Yes. And then they had a son named William Jr. Anyway, William started working down at the town dump and things were kind of looking up for a bit. You know, steady income, a growing family. But Mildred passed away, and it seemed like any normalcy was buried with her. Angola's population had grown, so there were now more kids, specifically teens, who started using Holland Drive as their makeout space, their party spot, all the things. But that's where the Derricks lived. And William didn't like anyone near his home because him and Mildred had they'd been hoarders.
Well, and also his entire life, he's been raised away from people, been taught not to trust people.
Right. So he put up pig heads on stakes in his yard, kind of like as a fence post, but it would be more than just pig heads. It was like sheep heads and all the things from the butcher that he worked for before. Like he would get all of that and he would use them.
God. Also as a way probably to deter people and keep them away.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, that's what he wanted to do. And he would also chase kids away from his property in his old Ford pickup truck, like, almost nightly. So now he was like the grouchy old man where kids would try to see what they can get away with. But in 1973, there was a man who was a utility worker who went missing. And he had last been seen on Holland Road near William's house. Which, again, reminded me of Making a Murderer. So it's like, well, it was near his house. Like, let's go see. So police searched the house, but all they found was that they could have been on an episode of Hoarders on TLC. And William Sr. was not there. You know, Mildred had passed away. But little Willie, a.k.a. William Jr., was there alone. And he was, quote, among filth, animal feces, and garbage. Which reminds me of that story that you did with that house that was, like, disgusting. And he thought he ran a cult, or maybe he did. It was, like, a teen. Do you remember that story? But it was, like, the messiest house ever.
Yes. That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
He was, like, a Satanist.
Yeah, he had a weird name.
Yeah.
And I can't think of it. So nothing can stick there. The utility worker's gone. All the things. But then, mysteriously, on October 31st, 1973, So Halloween, if you don't know, but the Derricks' home on Holland burned. No bodies were found in the rubble, but it was thought that William Sr. did pass away inside. And this is where things start to get weird.
Hold on. It was thought that he passed away?
Yeah, they're like, we can't find his body, but it was all burned to ash. So they're like, it's probably here somewhere. And again, the house was hoarder status. So I think they just kind of assumed since no one was there. Yeah.
That doesn't seem good, but okay.
Yeah. So we start hearing whispers about a figure that haunts Holland Road. And it's one of those narrow country back roads, you know, tucked under trees, full of blind curves that people love to speed around and everything. And it's already like the place that just seems a little wrong at night. There's no lights, no sign of life, just road and dark woods, which is why the kids would use it as their party spot, their makeout spot, all the things. And that's where people say that the Angola Pigman lives. I do want to say also, when William was alive, he like had worked at the dump and stuff, and people would then call him like a pig because one, how he looked, two, that they said that like he was disgusting and lived in like a pigsty. And then he would like, he worked at the dump, but he would go through the dump for like looking for stuff, you know? So people like, he would wear a hood because people would make fun of him. So he would wear like a hoodie all the time to try to do that. And so they just made it more like where he looked spooky, where he looked threatening, and he was trying to disguise himself.
That breaks my heart.
Absolutely. Now, how I said this story reminded me of something is that, like, as you're kind of putting two and two together, the legend is that the Pigman is William Derricks, you know, because it started showing up right after the fire, you know, he just up and vanished. And then there's this man who is seen, and it kind of becomes like folklore, which reminds me of Charlie No Face. If you remember that story of the guy that would walk up and down the interstate and stuff, and people said like he glowed, he didn't have a face, and it was because of a terrible accident and all of this. And it's like, he's a real fucking person.
Right.
Like, it's not, I don't know. And also, like, him doing the sideshow stuff, it just breaks my heart, too, because we've talked about people who've actually made livings and, like, a lot of money doing that, but he was more of the, quote, grotesque-looking ones. And so, of course, he was treated like shit. He didn't make anything, and that's why he ended up coming back. So he just had a hard fucking life all the way around. But let's get on with the stories about it, the sightings, the encounters, because they say if you go down Holland Road or Pigman Road, you shouldn't, because you can catch a sight of something unnatural at the end of the woods. People have described, you know, a tall figure, and some say that he's wearing a mask made of a pig's head, like not a costume store, like looking like you put it on for the Purge kind of mask.
Yeah.
But like an actual pig's head, like hollowed out and strapped on. Others say, no, that's not a mask. It's the face.
Yeah.
Like the face is a pig. He's half pig. But we know from hearing about William, that was due to his like frontonasal stuff. And like I said, kids had used that as their little hangout spot. Well, when they would be getting frisky, it was kind of like steaming up the windows and all the things. Kind of like on Titanic, you know, that one that we talk about all the time when her hand slides down.
Yeah.
So it'd be like that. And he would be in his hood when he was, quote, William, you know, when he was alive and was not this legend of the Pigman. He would like just kind of like bang on him and be like, hey, get out of here. Stop. And of course, it's going to scare them because they can't see outside. They're vulnerable in their positions and all of that. Well, that carried on afterwards. So like, was he still alive and like living somewhere else and just kind of like still trying to like keep his home, you know, like where his home was? I don't know. But people think that it was like a residual energy there that they would see the figure. They would hear guttural and animalistic snorting sounds coming from the woods that would scare them, which that's probably made up to where, you know, it's like, oh, it was snorting. But if he was like, hey, get out of here or something, like making a grunting noise, like hitting the car and stuff, like they probably said, ooh, a grunt, a snort. Now, one story comes from the 70s, and it's centered around a lot of teens who drove out to Holland Road late one night, windows down, radio blasting, and they were trying to have fun and like scare themselves. Well, they stopped near the bridge where the tracks used to run. They killed the lights and they waited. But after a few minutes, they heard movement in the brush nearby. And it wasn't like, oh, maybe that's a raccoon or anything. It's like, no, that's something big. And then all of a sudden, when they're like trying to be so quiet to hear what it is, something slammed into the side of the car. And one of the guys swears that he saw a flash of pale skin and what looked like a snout before it disappeared into the trees. But they didn't wait around to investigate. You know, they spun out on their fucking tires because theirs weren't flat like mine, and they were gone. A couple of years later, there was a couple hiking in the area during the day, and they said they found what looked to be like a shelter in the woods, kind of off the trail. And inside there were animal bones and like broken tools. And they said that the air felt very heavy and they felt like they weren't alone. So they hiked right back out, but they were like, that's the pigman's lair, which it could have been because the animal bones and stuff would have been from him scavenging for food because his house was burnt down on Halloween. So, you know, it was someone else. Like on Halloween, the house burned down after he's been like blackballed by the community, like kids terrorizing, all this stuff. Like they probably didn't mean to burn down his house. Probably some jackass flicked a cigarette over there, but he had all the shit in his house and it went up.
And they couldn't even be fucking bothered to decide if it was really him, like if he was really dead or not. So, you know, they didn't do any due diligence to see if the house was intentionally burned.
Right.
Like, how do you not figure out for sure if someone actually died in there or not?
I don't know.
I don't understand that.
I don't know. Like, that, yeah, it speaks volumes of how they thought of the Derrick family. Now, there's even a local person who used to work for a delivery company, and he said that once he had to drop off a package near the end of Holland Road, and he said it was like twilight. And while he was there, he was trying to find the house, but something crossed the road in front of him, and it was tall and it was fast, but it wasn't shaped like an animal, but it also had animalistic characteristics. He didn't stop the truck. He just kept on going and reported the delivery as unable to locate, which is why I would definitely get fired because it would be unable to locate a lot of the times. Swarm of bees, unable to locate. Raining outside, like a perpetual downpour, unable to locate. People also say that like the cell signal is weird there. Like their phones glitch, their car radios cut out, GPS keeps sending them in circles. But I'm like, look, that happens right by the Dollar General up in our neighborhood.
Right.
Like, it's a black hole.
I know. I'm like, you're literally in the woods. Of course it's like that.
Exactly. And so it's two camps where the pigman is like this boogeyman, this like mythical creature, almost a cryptid. So like he never was human to begin with, you know? And so he haunts this ground. And then there's the other camp of, no, this is William Derrick's. And, you know, had this terrible fucking life and a community that shunned him, that, you know, whatever, all the things I've told you. And then even in death, he is still trying to protect. The only thing he had was his home. But people say that they still see him or they feel him. They can hear that pig like snorting when they're going down the road. And, you know, they say, hey, if you have to go down the road, Watch out. It is winding. It is dark. And if you hear anything, just don't get out of your car.
Meanwhile, this poor guy can't rest in fucking peace.
Right. Well, and how long was he alive living off the land or whatever he was still trying to do that? Hell, he was probably looking for his son or something. I don't even know. It's just so sad. It's one of those things, again, where life is so much more fucking scary and terrifying and terrible.
And cruel.
Yeah. Than what you can make nightmares of.
Mm-hmm. Poor guy. Like, he seemed so angry because of his life circumstances, because mm-hmm. the way he was treated, because of the way that the people before him lived. Like, it's not his fault that people were marrying their first cousins. It's not his fault that he had these genetic issues because people, like, had kids with their first fucking cousin. But he gets treated terribly.
I don't know how well he was treated by his parents because they had to, like, keep him away from society because I think it was, like, to protect him, but also to try to protect themselves because that was just one more thing that people would say about them with their son. And I don't know. It's just...
Yeah, well, maybe don't marry your first fucking cousin and then... Or have babies with your first cousin and you won't have to worry about that. Isn't that against the law?
It's just so sad.
But isn't it against the law?
I think so.
Okay.
Y'all, behind the scenes, Carrie's freaking fire alarms went off.
Remember when they used to just randomly do that?
Yes.
Thank God Colby can reach it now, though. I don't have to go get a damn step stool. He just reaches up there and takes it down.
Oh, my gosh. But it's like, what is today?
I don't know.
And these were heavy-ass stories.
Everybody needs to, like, sage themselves, stand up, walk around your chair three times. I don't know, something.
Oh, my gosh.
Go get some ice cream.
Ooh, okay.
Don't go back to McDonald's, though, Donna. No. You're going to piss them off.
But I can't because my tire's going to be flat by the time they give me my frappe.
Well, thank y'all so much for listening to this episode. We know it was heavy, so thanks for sticking with us if you made it this far. Don't forget to check out all the upcoming events. And if you're like, how do I do that? Just go to the Facebook page or our Instagram and you'll see some stuff. And don't forget to like, subscribe, review, all the things. And remember,
creep it real
and don't get scared.